What is up? What is going on, everybody? We are talking about a film that has maybe the most self-aware tagline of all time. 2002's Minority Report, Everybody Runs. You know who's in it? You know what I'm talking about. We'll get into it on the other side of the song. Welcome back into another episode of The Threequel. As always, I'm one of your three co-hosts, Ethan Klein. Here with me, as always, Mike Duranik and Brad Miller. Gentlemen, how are we doing?
I'm doing great, Ethan. We're not doing any diving into Steven Spielberg, so it is going to be a great episode.
I don't know that I was aware of that tagline, Ethan, and so I'm doing better now because you're right. I mean, it plays on multiple levels, not just for the movie, but also for the lead actor. And so Spielberg must have been on to something.
Yeah, and he does quite a bit of running in this film. I think it's interesting. I just thought about this. This is our 20th episode of The Threequel. We have done two Todd Phillips films. We've done two Michael Bay films, and this is the first time we are doing a Steven Spielberg film. So I don't think many movie podcasts can say that they would put that much weight into the career of Michael Bay before they would touch on the career of Steven Spielberg. But we like to do things a little bit different here on The Threequel, and we will definitely talk about him and plenty about this film as this episode goes on. But I'll start it the way I always do, guys. This film came out actually the day before my birthday, June 21st, 2002. So in June of 2002, I don't know if you guys saw it in the theaters, maybe you saw it a little bit later, but what was your first experience with the film Minority Report? And then your thoughts on it back then that you brought into this rewatch here for this week's episode?
I have a kind of lame answer for this. I have no recollection of my first time watching it. I know I've seen it before, but I could not put a time or place to the film. So, let's see what you guys have to say about your first experience.
I'm not much better than Brad. I believe I saw this in the theater, and given the timeline of when it came out, that makes a lot of sense. That was at a period of time in my life when I was going to the theater. Pretty much any chance I could get with my friends for any excuse. And this certainly would have qualified as one that we would have likely seen. So I would imagine I probably saw it at the movie theater when it was out, but I can't say for certain.
Well, 6-year-old, a day short of being 7-year-old Ethan, did not go see this one in the theaters. It's funny, this actually came out against Lilo and Stitch. So I would put a lot of money on the fact that my birthday movie that year was Lilo and Stitch and not this. My first memory of seeing this for the first time, I can tell you, I know I didn't make it all the way through the movie because it was just a couple years later. It was on a TV channel. I recognized Tom Cruise. So I watched it. And what I saw was near the opening of the film, him buying the drugs and the guy with no eyes staring at him. And I probably didn't sleep for the next month and instantly turned it off. So my first interaction with Minority Report, not a positive one, probably when I was around 8-9 years old, catching it on TV. My opinions of the film have changed, but I think this is actually perfect. This is a great segue, the way that we all explained kind of how we remember the film, into our next segment, the segment we introduced a couple weeks ago, thesis statement. I bring in the biggest, boldest thought I have about the film, something rooted in hyperbole, something, you know, that if you hear this film get brought up at a party or around a group of people, you plant your flag in this statement and you say, this is absolutely the most definitive thing I can say about this movie. And I will fight anyone who disagrees. At least that may be the place that I'm coming from. So my thesis statement.
Before you said you didn't already say your thesis statement, because I thought I heard you say that this movie proved there's a really fine line between Michael Bay and Steven Spielberg.
No, was that not
what you said earlier?
If this movie was made by Michael Bay, this is the kind of movie that if Michael Bay made it would be one of the worst movies of all time. I can promise you that.
Okay, so no fine line.
No.
Because I was going to say, if that's the case, I don't think so.
No. My thesis statement for Minority Report is simply this. This is the most underrated, overlooked film in both of the careers of Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg.
All right, so tell us a little bit about it while I do the research to see if I agree with you here.
Well, so, I mean, the first and foremost, you know, the three of us, we can't really remember where we saw it. We know we've seen it. And, I mean, for me, we earlier, if you missed our Of Course I'm Right episode this week, we did the Mount Rushmore of Tom Cruise films. It was on all three of our lists. Mike and I had it in the actual Mount Rushmore. But I would say if you walk up to a majority of people and they first say, yes, I'm a Tom Cruise fan, yes, I'm a Steven Spielberg fan, I fully believe you're talking 80 to 90% of people wouldn't have this movie anywhere near their Mount Rushmore, right? It gets completely forgotten about. Box office wise, it was like the 15th highest grossing film of that year. It's the 17th highest grossing film of Steven Spielberg's career, which is astronomically insane. I mean, that's adjusted for inflation, but that is wickedly insane because to me, you cannot convince me that there are five better Steven Spielberg films than Minority Report. And I'd probably, it is up there for me near Saving Private Ryan and the ones that are considered the absolute classics. And I think there's a lot of things kind of working against that we can get into, but I just want just kind of putting that out there now. Where are you guys feeling when I initially make this claim?
So this is probably the one that you've said that initially makes the most sense to me. Because the very first thing that you see before the credits roll is directed by Steven Spielberg. And I made the comment last night that I had no idea this was one of his films. And I just went, huh. I started to think back, like, what were there things in the film that pointed it, you know, towards being one of his? And I couldn't really, you know, pinpoint what those moments were. But in its totality, it is a really, really good film. I know we just did our Mount Rushmore of Tom Cruise films, and it was a little bit lower on my list than on your guys's, but it wasn't because it wasn't a really good film, because I really did like it. It's more because, you know, for nostalgia purposes or other things, you know, some things hopped up on my list higher than Minority Report. But yeah, did you say the words you used were most overlooked? Like, can you say it again?
Overlooked and underrated for both of their careers.
As far as Tom Cruise goes, yeah, I would say that I could get there on that. I don't know enough about Steven Spielberg's total, you know, movie canon to really say. So I'll kind of rely on your guys' expertise there, but it's definitely not too far off.
So I agree, Brad. When I was watching this, it struck me that I had no clue, or at least did not remember that Spielberg had directed this. And so that definitely is a point in favor, Ethan, of your argument. I don't know that I bite as much with Cruise, except as we talked about on Of Course I'm Right, when we were looking at our Mount Rushmore's of Cruise movies, I do think the majority of people, when you ask them to think about Tom Cruise, and they probably immediately go to the Mission Impossible movies at this point, would be my guess, just because of the fact that I'm not a fan of those and haven't watched the more recent ones, doesn't make that not the case. And so if that's the case, and most people, you're walking down the street, you say, hey, what movies are Tom Cruise in? If they would go more naturally towards those, they might name Top Gun. They might go back to some of his movies in the 80s. It's possible that this one could kind of slip through the cracks, even with people regarding Tom Cruise as well. And certainly it was number two on my list. I don't know how, if we made a Mount Rushmore of Spielberg movies, that this would make the actual Mount Rushmore, but it would probably be in the honorable mentions, at least for me. So I can see that argument. Yeah, I think that's a solid, it'd be a fun, full-fledged debate to have, particularly if you had it with a couple of people who were well versed in Spielberg's entire filmography as well as Cruise's.
Yeah, and I think when you just kind of look at the things that surround it, I mean, Spielberg at this point in his career most of the things that he puts his name on are getting nominated for multiple Academy Awards, and specifically probably getting nominated for Best Picture. I mean, when you look at things like The Post, Bridge of Spies, most in the last 5-6 years, that both get nominated for Best Picture, to me, that is entirely because his name is on it. Not that those movies are bad movies, but those are not, to me, that's something that I watched and I was like, oh yes, this is a contender for the best made film of the year. And so when you compare that to something like Minority Report in 2002, a very weak year, and it's the year that Chicago won Best Picture, and its probably greatest competition was the second Lord of the Rings film, which I think is an infinitely better movie than Chicago, but a pretty weak year in film. And this is something that gets widely swept under the rug in terms of accolades. It got nominated for some sound design things and things like that. But those are technical things that, while those people deserve credit, are not things that movies are remembered for being successful in. And then box office wise, $100 million budget. It makes about 350 worldwide. So successful, yes, but hit, no. When you compare that to War of the Worlds a couple years later, now again, bigger name property, it's a remake, but the same duo, Spielberg and Tom Cruise, that's about $150 million budget that makes almost $700 million. And I can tell you right now, if you compare those movies side by side, the wrong one made $700 million.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I don't know that anybody could have a reasonable argument against that. And I think that's another point towards your argument that War of the Worlds grossed twice as much, roughly, as this one, but was probably not even quite half the movie.
For sure. So let's shift gears a little bit. We obviously, earlier this week, you can go check out Of Course I'm Right. We gave our Mount Rushmores of Tom Cruise's career, so we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on him. I think for me, I guess here's the question. Here's what I'll pose to you guys. And Brad, you answered this a little bit, so Of Course I'm Right. Go back and check that out. But Mike, you and I didn't really touch on this. Do you consider Tom Cruise a frontline movie star? Tom Cruise is in a movie. I am excited and I'm going to see it.
Yeah. So before we did our Of Course I'm Right podcast, and I'd even, I think, alluded to that in there. It was, yeah, I think he is the type of person that if I see his name on a movie, I'm intrigued. Then as I heard you guys kind of talking a little bit more, I kind of started to backpedal from that opinion. You know, Brad, and I think you, Ethan, have pointed out that there are a lot of duds in there as well. All things equal, though, I think that he is a pretty reliable box office draw. Some of that may be tied up into, Mission Impossible movies, but not exclusively. I think that he's had some other movies over the last 10 years that have been quite successful with him as the lead. And so, I see him as being a box office draw as much as most people are in this day and age. He's certainly not The Rock, but, you know, short of that, I don't know who else is a more guaranteed box office draw than he is at this point.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with that. And, you know, if you're kind of talking like nationwide, you know, who are some of the biggest movie stars? I think for sure he's right up there with just about anybody else as far as, you know, who's going to bring in the most, you know, put the butts in the seats, make some money for the director, you know, however you want to rank movie stars. But for me, I realized that like just him being in a movie is not going to get me to see it. I can't even really remember seeing, I've seen very few of his movies in theater. So he's one of those that, you know, I'll get around to seeing some of the films and I enjoy most of them, but he's not a draw for me to take my, you know, $10 and say, I'm going to go buy a movie ticket and spend a couple hours of my day going out to see one of his films. So that's kind of how I would put it. Like, it's just not enough for me to part with that money. So he can't be up there for me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think for the most part, I agree with you guys. I think what ends up happening is, like, I would have no desire to meet Tom Cruise in real life, right? Like, Tom Cruise, the man, could care less, but it, and a lot of it is his marketing team. A lot of it is probably his agent having those conversations. What projects do we and don't we take? But by and large, and again, like, I mean, his misses have been big misses, but he has had a successful career because the films he picks to me and to a large demographic like me that spend their money at the theater, the guy just puts out hits. I mean, the Mission Impossible movies are a great example of, like, those first couple, they didn't really know what they wanted to be. It was kind of falling off. But since Mission Impossible 3, I mean, now we're getting ready to see Mission Impossible 7 and 8, right? Like, the guy knows what he's doing. He's a very smart businessman. He's very smart. He's producing his own movies now for the last, for a good long while. It's actually funny, a lot of the behind the scenes stuff here, he wanted to do a lot more of his own stunts for this film. And Spielberg said, no, like, I'm not going to be on the hook for my lead actor, you know, breaking his back, doing his own stunts. And then, you know, the years following this film is when he started producing his own films and said, no, it's fine. I'll put my money on it. I'll be the insured one. And I will break my own back someday. So, you know, he has developed kind of this brand, and it's been very successful for him. So let's talk about, I mean, we could talk about Max von Sydow, but I don't know. I mean, he's been in movies for a long time. He's a legend. If you see him, you know who he is. But I think the more interesting conversation to have here is Colin Farrell. And I'd kind of toyed around with a thesis statement about him, but I wanted to keep that a little more focused on the movie. I am a big Colin Farrell fan, and I don't know where you guys are at with it, but him to me is like one of the biggest missed opportunities for an A-list star in my lifetime. Right? Like, he got the push, and maybe the flip side of it, where Tom Cruise has great people working with him, Colin Farrell should fire every person that's ever given him advice on which movies he should and shouldn't be in, because he should have been an A-list, like, the guy, but has made some awful decisions in his career on what to be in.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought this up, because I was toying as well with saying, like, you know, hey, I've got a hot take for you, maybe not a thesis statement, but it's that Colin Farrell, way better in my mind than he is as an actual actor. When I went through, again, his filmography, I think that I kind of feel like the two best roles that I can think of with him in after going through that are this particular movie, his role in this. He does a great job. He knocks it out of the park. He comes across as cocky and confident, which Colin Farrell almost always does, but not so much so that it's annoying. And then for number two, I would go with his one episode cameo arc on the television show Scrubs. I feel like in my mind, Colin Farrell is this huge, awesome, dynamic actor. And then I look through his films and I'm like, meh, like, if Colin Farrell wasn't even a thing, would I know any better? This may be the one movie that I can point to and say, when he's on the screen, I am connected, I am locked in, and I'm enjoying his performance.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. I've enjoyed some of Colin Farrell's stuff, but when he pops up in a movie for me, I find myself, like, he has to prove himself to me. I don't look at him and say, oh, this is going to be an awesome scene because he's in it, or this is going to be an awesome film because he's in it. It's almost like I just say, okay, there's Colin Farrell. Now prove to me why you were chosen for this. You know, like, I've never seen a guy, too, that could probably be considered so handsome and also so, like, gross at the same time. He always looks dirty. He always looks greasy. He always looks like he just got done, you know, doing a workout or something. And yet he's still got that, you know, Hollywood hunk sort of vibe that a lot of people talk about. But he's such a juxtaposition every time I see him, because like you guys say, he walks on screen, you think, okay, this is a movie star. But then you don't really get that vibe as you're watching it. And same thing as when you consider the looks and stuff like that. So yeah, he's just kind of a walking contradiction in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think for me, I do believe in his ability. Every time I see him on screen, I'm like, awesome, I get to see Colin Farrell work. And what has just happened for a majority of his career is just, I walk out of the movie going, son of a bitch, there's another one that we just wasted. Like, he picked another bad one. I mean, you know, when I heard that he was going to be in season two of True Detective, you know, him, Vince Vaughn, Taylor Kitsch, Rachel McAdams, oh yeah, we're following. And it, and through no fault of Colin Farrell, he was probably the best part of it, steaming pile of trash. Like, it's just bad choice. Horrible Bosses, he's amazing in that, in a comedic role, right? And if you, they, you know, if you can make someone laugh, you can make someone cry. If you have that kind of comedic ability in you, you can act. And he can. Crazy Heart, Jeff Bridges wins the Academy Award for it. He goes toe-to-toe with him that entire movie whenever he's on screen with him. He's fantastic in it. Smaller part, but a lot of the times he's been given the lead, the movies have not succeeded. And for me, it's been a disappointment because I am a fan. But in this, we're going to specifically talk about this, Mike, like you mentioned. He comes on screen. He is cocky. You don't like him. You're not supposed to. But the arc that he delivers, I think by the end of it, what I really noticed this time is that we have no reason to dislike him by the end of it. He's just a guy doing his job. Mm-hmm. And he's not wrong. I mean, the issues that he has with Tom Cruise, he has every right to have. Tom Cruise is a drug addict. Like, he is being charged with leading this thing that is very fragile and has a lot of moral ambiguity to it, probably shouldn't be left in the hands of a drug addict, right? So he's not wrong in what he's doing. He's just juxtaposed against the guy whose story we're being told. And by the end of it, I mean, his death, it hurts, because that's really all he was doing. It was just his job.
Yeah, and he also, I think, maybe the perfect foil for Cruise in that, you know, when they have that scene where they're running, you know, all the way across the city, and then they're into the warehouse where they're building the cars and things like that, and they're fighting, and Cruise, you know, punches him, and he ends up with, like, I think a bloody nose. Like, you're really cheering for Tom Cruise there, right? Because Colin Farrell kind of has that face, like Brad mentioned, handsome yet sleazy. It's a punchable face, and so you're cheering for it throughout this. But certainly by the end, all of a sudden he almost swings himself into like savior mode, where he's figured this out and he is going to crack this whole thing and he's the one. And then right when you start to get yourself into the mindset that he is going to save the day, his character is not necessarily going to be redeemed, because as you pointed out, Ethan, he's just doing his job, but his character is going to fully resolve and maybe end up being the good guy through the whole thing, right? Because he was the one with the moral authority through the whole thing. And then, boom, he's dead. And you're like, oh, the movie's not over yet. It kind of felt like it was moving towards wrapping up, and yet here we are.
My next question, before we get into some of our games, and I'll just put it simply this way, we'll see where the conversation goes. Would you guys vote yes to this system? Is this system a fair and just way to handle justice? Is this system justified?
So to make sure I'm following you, the question is, if beings were found that had the gift of foresight and could see when people were going to kill someone out, someone else beyond a shadow of a doubt, so to speak, would you vote for the system and say, yes, put it in place? That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you brought this up, because to me, this is what makes this such a strong movie. Is it's not just an action flick. It's not just a thriller. It's not just kind of a murder mystery. It is a deep philosophical piece about the nature of humanity and free will. And so to that end, I can say, no, I wouldn't. And the reason is, I don't believe that things are preordained, right? I may be entirely wrong on this, but I think that that's more of like a Calvinist point of view, right? That everything's preordained and our stories are already written. And that's not my theological, you know, religious kind of belief. It's not the way that I see the world going around. And so, you know, I think that the climax of this movie proves that point, right? Just because you are absolutely set to do this doesn't mean that you will do it. Everybody has a choice. You have a choice. And so for those reasons, I wouldn't. But I do think that it raises an interesting question, because I can say I suspect that if this did come to pass, that it would probably pass up with an overwhelming vote in our society, even if I would be on the vote no side of things.
Yeah, I'm almost exactly where Mike is with it. Like, I think that it would be voted yes because people aren't going to be murdered, you know? But the one line that Colin Farrell states is like, it's very true in this, is that this is a flawed system because it's human. These are humans that are being, you know, I guess they're gifted and have this that, but the title of the movie itself suggests that there's going to be problems. The Minority Report of the discrepancies between each of the visions creates issues. And like, just because they see a murder happening doesn't mean that, I mean, could that person change their mind at the last second? Could, you know, something else happen, or could it prevent goodness from happening? Because someone's death in the past has created better things for our future. So, you know, like, there are people that have been martyred that have created movements, you know. One person died, like, I mean, look at George Floyd. Like, would we go back and prevent his death if we could? Probably, because who wouldn't want that man to be alive? But also look what it did to bring systemic racism to the forefront, and hopefully over the next decade create a massive change in our society. And I hate that someone had to die to maybe make something better, but what if preventing his death in that moment meant that racism was always going to be around? And I know that some listeners are going to kind of look at that and be like, okay, so he's justifying someone's death, but that's not what I mean. I mean, the bad thing already happened. So now that it happened and some good hopefully will come from it, a lot of good, would you go back and change it and then totally erase all of that good happening? I don't know. I mean, it's a tough question, but I think because I'm like Mike and don't believe in that Calvinistic view, I think I would have to also say no to the system as a whole.
For me, I would say no, and just for a couple of different things that I noticed just in the film. They have the moment when Colin Farrell and Tom Cruise, they roll the ball, right? And Colin Farrell catches it, and Tom Cruise uses it as an example of why pre-crime is good. Because it was going to happen, but you stopped it from happening. But we all know it was going to happen. But I looked at it from a perspective of, play that out, and let's say that Tom Cruise was given the rule of, you cannot let this ball touch the ground. You will be punished if the ball touches the ground. That whole thing played out. Colin Farrell stopped it from touching the ground. You wouldn't then go back and punish Tom Cruise, because it didn't. Things happened. You stopped the act from happening, but you wouldn't then go back and retroactively punish Tom Cruise because his actions could have led to what you told him not to do. Right. So like in the situation of a police officer walks in on someone with a gun pointed at another person, they clearly have the intent to harm and kill. That person's going to get arrested and punished, but they're not going to get sentenced to life for not murdering someone. Right. Like, we can look at that situation and say, yes, if that wasn't stopped, murder was going to happen. But you're not going to then try someone for a murder that didn't happen. There's just so many paradigms just from a legal perspective and from a from the perspective of someone, you know, serving out a punishment and potentially changing their life when there's no crime committed. And we especially see it because Tom Cruise makes a different choice when he's faced with the opportunity to kill the man that he in that moment thinks killed his son. And if you go into just the initial scene, which the opening scene of this film is fantastic, that is amazing filmmaking. But if someone would have just walked up to him and said, hey, if you go in that house, you're going to kill your wife, how different would the situation be? Instead of just, we run in and arrest him because we think he's going to kill his wife because someone said he is. If you're given the option of, this will happen if you take one step in that house, it completely changes the outcome of the scenario based on what it would have been, theoretically.
I think also with that, it's all about like we're in this, and this feels preventative, right? We are stopping these murders from happening, but yet it's not as if this is stopping them from going and arresting these people, right? They're still doing it. They're still, they've got up to 4 days lead time for a pre-planned, premeditated murder. They have far less time for a crime of passion, but it's not as if this system has gone into place and now Tom Cruise is back out of a job because it's been so effective that it has stopped at least the premeditated murders. And so it also comes to the root of an issue of a system like this is that not only does it not give the person a chance, you're almost setting them up in a weird way with some sort of an entrapment is I think kind of what you're getting at, is like you could have stopped them and counseled them out of it, but instead we're just going to put them in a zombie state for the rest of their lives. It presumes that people can't change and that circumstances are always going to be what they are. And also it's a society that's still not trying to get to the root issue of why do people murder, right? Why do people commit crimes? Rather than solving those problems, we're just waiting for those problems to rear their ugly head. And then we're putting people away for the rest of their lives, which again is a flaw in the system.
Yeah. I thought it last night when I was watching it, like, wow, this person's being arrested, especially with that first murder. He's being arrested for something he doesn't even realize that he did yet. Obviously, it was close enough in the way they timed that he was clearly going to either severely hurt that person or murder that person. But then he's being put on, a pseudo trial and haloed for something that didn't even happen. And I realized in the moment that it seemed odd, but hearing you guys talk about it, it really brings the point home that you're right. They're putting these people in, I think you said, a zombie state for something that they haven't even done yet. It was definitely a flawed system that hopefully would never have any kind of basis in reality if we do come up with some way to predict the future. Through technology or a gifted human like, you know, Michael Jackson or something.
So before we move into our kind of end game, because you're ready to kind of move there, yeah, Ethan?
We're trending that way.
So I have one more question for you that I'm curious what you guys think about this. So they finally catch up to Tom Cruise and they halo him, right? The entire end of the movie was supposed to just be Tom Cruise's fantasy, and none of that actually happened. He never confronts, Burgess or whatever. And the thing that really tipped me off is like the fantasy kind of is him getting back together with his wife and then they're expecting another kid, right? Yep. So what do you think about that? Any chance that the entire end of this movie was almost like too cute by half and it was an entire misdirection that just was so good that it doesn't play like that on the surface?
I have heard that theory before. And a lot of times I shake off theories like that because it's just, I mean, you can go round and round. That is one of the ones, and this is one of the movies that theory has, I've been on both sides of it a lot. And the thing about the ending that has always leaned towards the side of it is a dream is when she is pregnant, something has just seemed off about the fact that they're in that apartment still. I don't know why that seems off, but the fact that they would go there, not that they necessarily need to go back to that house, but like Agatha has the vision, right? And she says there's so much love in this house. Like there's nothing but hate and pain in that apartment for him. And I don't know if maybe that even means that it's real, but something is just off about the idea of the two of them spending their days together in that place, because that place seems like such a, just a dark, deep hole for him that he wouldn't want to be in anymore. That's the place he got high and watched videos of his dead kid, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually a great point, because it's not as if he would be needing to stay in that apartment for his job, because in this end game, his job doesn't exist anymore.
That's an interesting point of view. Ethan, I've never been on either side of this because this is the first time I'm hearing it. So I'd have to kind of dissect that thought. I will say, this part would make sense because speaking of, we talked about a fine line earlier, jokingly about, you know, Michael Bay and Steven Spielberg, but this movie to me walked a very fine line between being very mediocre and being fantastic. And there was that, there's a spot where things start to get figured out. And to me, that's where it clicks. When you start to see the pieces coming together for people, it stopped being a mediocre movie for me. And the second, maybe, or the last like 40% of the film is fantastic. The first 60% of this to me was a little bit pretentious, a little bit corny. The graphics weren't great. The CGI stuff was, I guess, not up to standard. And I think they went a little bit too far with their prediction of future technologies and things like that. And it was just, it just didn't hit the mark. But then, yeah, at some point it switched and jumped to the other side of that fine line and became a really, really fantastic movie. But that would also be in line with some of the stuff that Mike's saying about the fantasy part. Like maybe this is an alternate reality that's in his mind. And maybe that was never, the system was never brought down. And, you know, the guy, Colin Farrell, kept being a dick, as Ethan put it, you know. Maybe Burgess was never caught. Maybe they never had another kid. The part that stood out to me about the Agatha thing in the story that she's telling him and his wife is, why didn't she tell him to run earlier? Like, why did she wait until the people were right there to say, hey, you better run? Like, that didn't make any sense to me. If she can see it and knows it's coming, why wait till he's trapped? I don't know if there's an answer to that or not, but
I mean, I took it, and if we play it out that everything that happened in this movie actually happened, if she can see everything, then maybe the only way that she saw justice coming for her mother was things playing out the way that they did. Like, if he just constantly stays on the run and the vote gets passed and it goes national, and then it's a national thing versus this one guy who's killed. Because remember, at that point, they've now accused him of killing Colin Farrell's character, too. So he's killed two people. He's clearly not trustworthy. He's a drug addict. Like, there would be no way for him to be able to prove anything. Like, the one shot they had of pulling this off was the way that it happened. And maybe she saw that.
Yeah, and that's probably a strong argument for everything did happen as it plays out, because given her gift of precognition, she maybe more or less walks him into it. Almost a Doctor Strange-esque, this is the one way that this works out that way. And so, you know, sorry, Tony, but you got to die. Well, sorry, John, but you got to get caught, sort of thing. So interesting.
Yeah, that's this is what, I mean, to me, this is what makes this a fantastic film and one that I love, because it offers up all these different conversations. Let's shift gears. Let's play a game, gentlemen, the Rotten Tomatoes game. Brad, you are going first this week. These two guys try to guess the sitting Rotten Tomatoes critic score of the film we're talking about, and see who can get closer and win the game. So, Brad, what do you think the sitting score is for Minority Report?
So most of the time I don't even think about this until we get to this point of the podcast, and I just kind of pick a number based on where I'm at. I actually watched the film thinking, like, okay, how would this be rated? And I kind of landed on 91. 91 being the number, because I think it's, for a lot of people, it ends up being really, really fantastic in the way it comes full circle at the end. So it's a pretty high number, but that's where I'm going to land.
Well, I was going to be in the high upper 80s, but with Brad going 91, I feel like the smarter thing to do is to snipe him. So I will go down to 90 rather than where I was going to be, which was going to be 88 or 89.
Well, you guys have changed roles. Brad snaked Mike last week, and now, Mike, with you using that tactic, you have hit the number on the head. It is sitting at 90%. Critic score Rotten Tomatoes. It's down to 80% for the fans. And I think that, you know, we've had that long conversation about overlooked, underrated. To me, this is a 4.5 out of 5 stars when I review this film. So I'm in the 90% range.
I'm going to take the credit for that victory because Mike wouldn't have got it right if I didn't pick 91. So
I was coin tossing 88 or 89 and probably would have settled on 88, but it made sense for me to try to box you out.
I made Mike hedge his bet and pick 90. So yeah, I get at least half the credit there.
That's fine. We'll give Brad half a point in the scorebook. But again, it's interesting. You know, the critics 90%, but again, no accolades at the Academy Awards. So just a weird reaction, I guess, to this film overall. But let's keep going, guys. Favorite line, favorite scene. Let's do favorite line first, and we'll cap it off with favorite scene. I think I'll go first. This is tough. The line that gets delivered that gives me kind of the biggest reaction I had on this rewatch, it just reminded me of the first time I saw it, was actually him reading Leo Crow his Miranda rights. Because I remember seeing this the first time and just like, you're in that scene, you're from the perspective of Agatha, right? We're no longer seeing this story through John's eyes. We're seeing it through Agatha's eyes because we want so badly too for him to take control of his future and walk away. And there's such a relief. And like Mike said, probably the best acting that Tom Cruise gives in the film, how hurt he is, how broken he is, then how violent he gets, and then finally realizing I have the power to take control of my own future when he starts saying that, and he's still breaking down a little bit as he's saying it, because obviously every part of him still wants to kill this guy because he thinks it's the guy that took his son from him. But I think that's the most powerful acting in the film, and I think I just remember when he says that line, the relief of, okay, he's doing something different here. So that to me was my favorite delivered line in the film.
Yeah, for me, it was a very simple line, and I don't even know exactly why it's my favorite, other than the fact that it really stood out to me.
Everybody runs.
Not everybody runs. It's actually when Burgess and Tom Cruise's wife in the film are together, and Burgess, you know, accidentally says the drowning part. It really stood out to me because what didn't make sense is why, if in that moment she felt like he was responsible, he was the killer, why reveal that you caught it? Why reveal that you know, understood that I never said that she drowned? Because who knows what this guy's going to do? Who knows what he is physically capable of doing to her? Like, it didn't make sense. Like, okay, if I caught one of you in a lie, why in that moment, if I think something dangerous could happen, would I tell you that I caught you in a lie? You know, like, and I'm glad. I guess the other part too is like, if this reality did really happen in the film, it flipped her into being a badass. You know, she pulled the gun on the guy. She got her husband back. She was for everything happening based on that one conversation that she had with Burgess, which is why I'm picking that as my favorite line of the film.
Yeah. So for me, there were a lot of really good lines in this, a lot of really good dialogue. You know, I think that for ultimately, I liked the dialogue and it kind of the monologue that Cruise gives towards Burgess at the end, right? Hello, Lamar. I just wanted to congratulate you. You did it. You created a world without murder. And all you had to do was kill someone to do it. And I just like, again, the hypocrisy in it and all of the moral questions of this movie, I think, just kind of drive through that dialogue in that situation.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Switching gears to favorite scene, Mike, maybe you alluded to yours. I know we've touched on mine a little bit, so I'll go with it, but it is the scene where Colin Farrell actually dies. That's my favorite scene. Just the whole setup of it, him calling in Burgess, because in that moment, I mean, when he brings him there, I don't think that he necessarily is assuming that Burgess is behind it. I think it's almost like he gives that last little line, like he's talking about the ripples in the waves, right? And I just remember when that was revealed, whenever it was, again, the first time that I saw this all the way through, I just remember being like, oh, that's it, right? Like, we've been staring at this woman for this entire movie. What is so special about this? How is there anything about, you know, they caught the guy that did it. What's going on? Where is she? I don't know. And it's just the ripples in the water. It's such a simple thing, but it takes a guy like him. You know, all these other guys aren't actually cops. They were brought in after this. He is a cop. He is doing his job as a police officer, solving a crime that no one else knows even happened. And it's just that simple detail. And then it clicks for him. And, you know, he said, like, but it would have had to be someone who had access. And then just how quick Max von Sydow, with a great performance, just turns and just that, you know, like, do you hear that? You know, there's no sirens, there's no spiders, and then just that gunshot and just that image of him sliding down. And he's almost kind of like gives a grin, like, I did figure it out. I just didn't get there soon enough. And I just think that's a fantastic reveal scene and great acting on both of their parts. So that's my favorite scene.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I just to pick a different scene, I'll do that, but I think that was also my favorite. I'm going to go with a little more subtle scene, and that's the one where he meets the old lady and he starts, you know, getting sick, and then she gives him the anecdote. But like, I said the wrong word again, antidote.
She also gives him an anecdote.
Yeah, she does. And for whatever reason, I just like that because she's revealing stuff to him to help him figure out, but also it's mysterious enough that it makes you wonder. And it was just a great performance. I like how that played out in setting up the next, you know, portion of the film. And I'm surprised that I enjoyed that scene so much, but as I was watching it last night, it really was like, hey, this is a very cool part of the film that just kind of stood out to me for several different reasons. So that's what I'm gonna pick, even though Ethan, I think ultimately I'd land where you did with that scene between Burgess and Colin Farrell.
Yeah, and for me again, Burgess and Farrell's character, that's probably my favorite. But the close runner-up was the one that you mentioned in terms of your favorite line, Ethan, and that is just the hotel room scene, in particular, just watching Cruz figure out what's going on or what he thinks is going on in there, having the reality wash over him that in this situation, undoubtedly, I'm going to kill this man, right? That there is no Minority Report, that this was going to happen. And they're absolutely right. Like, I've always wondered what would happen when I found the man who took my son. I'm going to kill him. And then watching him deal with that all the way through to making the decision not to kill him. It's a dynamic scene. I think, you know, Agatha has some exceptional acting in that scene as well. The screaming, the horror kind of on her face as she's seeing this violence. So that's a great scene. And really just some solid scenes all the way through this movie.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. So there's just one last thing left to do, guys. There's three categories that we put the films in here on the threequel. Those three are stiff drink, mixed drink, and case of beer. So basically, case of beer, movies off the rails. You got to have a whole case to really enjoy what you're seeing there. It's a lot of non-serious, just some kind of wild things happening. Mixed drink, a little bit of both. It's some action. It's some seriousness. Maybe it's an action movie with a great performance grounding the entire thing, something like that. Then the stiff drink is just a completely serious film. And to me, this is absolutely, it's the first one down these rankings, but it's a stiff drink. This is maybe the darkest movie in the Tom Cruise filmography, right? I mean, I almost said for both of them, but of course, like, there's Schindler's List that will always take the cake for Steven Spielberg. But, and maybe this is why it is kind of overlooked. It's not the movie people expect. If you put those two guys together, this isn't the tone of film you would expect out of Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg, right? The guy with no eyes was horrifying to me as a child. Agatha, her acting is fantastic in this film, but those screams are horrifying. And then the song that plays whenever you see Anne Lively, that song has stuck with me throughout the years. So this is absolutely, to me, clearly the stiff drink category.
I would agree with you. I think that it's not totally what totally there. There is some action in it, but I think it definitely trends darker. It trends more serious. It asks some pretty tough questions about society in general, about our propensity to do good and to do bad, about free will and choice. And so given the parameters that you've kind of put on our assessment here, I would agree with you. I think stiff drink.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think the darkness, the heavy questions, the theological stuff that you see, the societal stuff, like, yeah, definitely a dark film that would be a stiff drink.
All right, guys, that does it for our conversation about Minority Report. We hope you enjoyed that. Thank you so much for the support. Remember, leave a comment, leave a review, and we will we'll throw you in Pappy's corner if you give us that support, unless you are Pappy. And once again, as always, you know what? I haven't said the F word in a couple weeks. We'll leave it alone. But you know how I feel about you, Pappy. Next week, guys, we're going to start a 2-week journey into Batman, specifically Christopher Nolan's Batman. So next week we're going to be doing Batman Begins, and then we will follow it by kicking off July with The Dark Knight. Just seemed a little too obvious to go that route, so we're going to do a little 2-week journey through the mind of Christopher Nolan, how he viewed Batman in those films. So certainly looking forward to that. But again, that's next week. This was Minority Report. Thank you so much for checking this out. Let us know. Let your friends know about the threequel. Have them listen as well. And again, join us on Tuesdays for Of Course I'm Right. But other than that, guys, for Mike, for Brad, I'm Ethan, and we'll see you next time.